This is Utah Public Radio. Thank you for joining us this evening for our live coverage of the Vote Utah 2012 debate for Utah House District 4 between candidates Ed Redd of the Republican Party and Doug Thompson of the Democratic Party. Support comes from the University Inn and Conference Center at USU, open to the public, featuring a 400-seat auditorium, covered parking, and remodeled guest rooms and suites of the University Inn. Online at conference.usu.edu. Moderator of tonight's debate is Michael Lyons, Professor of Political Science at Utah State University. Special thanks to the Utah State University College Democrats. To hear a repeat of this debate, tune into Utah Public Radio Monday morning at 9 o'clock during Access Utah.
Welcome, everybody. We are so pleased to have you here tonight at our USU College Democrats debate. My name is Brianna Bowen. I'm the president of USU College Democrats. This year, our main focus has been getting the community and the student body involved and aware of the political process. This is a wonderful year because we have the election to look forward to. Tonight, our District 4 candidates have graciously consented to appear for a debate moderated by Dr. Michael Lyons of the USU Political Science Department, and we are thrilled to have them with us. We would like to welcome our candidates to the stand, and we will proceed with the debate.
I'm pleased to be here with this opportunity to moderate the debate. Let me go over the rules very briefly. Each candidate will address each question that I will ask and have 90 seconds for his response. We will alternate between first responses, and we should have tossed a coin previously. I'll toss one in my head here, and I'll say Mr. Redd will give the first answer to the first question, and we'll go back and forth. Candidates will also be given brief opportunities at my discretion to respond to the answer given by the other candidate or amplify on their original 90-second answer. I may occasionally follow up with a question of my own. The questions were written by the College Democrats. I wrote some of the questions myself, and Professor Damon Kahn also participated in the writing of the questions. And I would ask our listeners at home and the people here in the classroom, please be patient with all of us. This is a new experience for the three of us. These two gentlemen have, insofar as I know, never run for the state legislature before. And my only experience moderating debates is mediating disputes between my teenage daughters. So I'm new to this, too. Our first question, first to Mr. Redd, then to Mr. Thompson, would be simply to ask you to introduce yourself to our audience and to explain what motivates you to run for the Utah State Legislature as the representative in District 4.
Okay. My name's Ed Redd. I'm a physician. I've been here in Cache Valley for 23 years. I've worked in private practice. I've worked in the public health department for the last 7 years. I've worked in Cache County Jail with the inmates. I've worked at Barrow Mental Health. And I've got sort of a broad base of experience, I think, in our community. I feel like I've had a great life here in Cache Valley. The community has been very kind to me over the years, and I feel like this is an opportunity for me to give back to my community.
Thank you, Mr. Redd. Mr. Thompson.
My name is Doug Thompson, and the reason why I'm running, quite frankly, is because I was asked, and I hadn't really had any thought about it until some people asked me to run, and the more I thought about it, the more excited I got. I feel like for most of my life, I have been involved with the legislature in one way or another, and being a political junkie, I've followed what they do a lot. And having lived a little longer than Ed and not being able to keep a job, I've got a lot of broad-based experience in a lot of different areas that I think will be directly applicable to the legislature. And so I am a native of Utah, went to Utah State, got a degree in economics, and went to another school, a red one, down in Salt Lake, who we gratefully beat a while ago, and got an MBA. My most recent experience, I was public relations and foundation director at Logan Regional Hospital, and prior to that, I was Logan mayor for 8 years.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thompson. Let's jump in with some substantive discussion of issues. And you can, as you can imagine, at a university, education is on people's minds. And we've got kind of a broad-based question for you on education in the K through 12 system in Utah generally, public education, obviously. What would you do, and I guess Mr. Thompson is first in this case, what would you do to improve the quality of public education K through 12 in the state of Utah?
Well, first of all, I think we've got very good teachers, and we've got very well-intentioned administrators. And I think we do remarkably well for the resources we have. And I think we can be proud of that. But we are at the bottom of per-pupil spending in America. And a while ago, back in the mid-90s, we were near the top, or at least close to the top 10, as far as effort is concerned. A greater percentage of our taxes and revenue for the state was going to education, and that effort mark put us, you know, at least at 12th. Now we've kept slipping and slipping and slipping to where we are way below the middle, and are having problems maintaining that. And I think the biggest problem we've got is where can we get revenue for K through 12. And in 1996, there were pretty good revenue. But there were some bills passed by the legislature that challenged the steady revenue stream that K through 12 had. And eventually it was siphoned off to road projects, frankly, to universities. And I think we need to get back closer to that kind of a formula they used to have. Another thing I think would be very helpful is that Utah doesn't have a severance tax on coal. And I think that having a reasonable tax on that would be very beneficial if we could apply that directly to education.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Redd.
Sure. I think, you know, some of the problems that face our schools, I agree with Mr. Thompson, our schools really are doing a really good job with the resources they have. And we have some incredibly, you know, competent and dedicated teachers in our public education system. I think some of the problems that are facing our Logan School District, at least, which is the district which we represent, is adequate funding for at-risk students, particularly starting in kindergarten and before kindergarten. We're talking about children of foreign-born parents who may not speak English, children who have disabilities, other problems where they start school already behind the game. And funding for that's inadequate in our current district's situation. We only have about one-third of the funding we actually spend, meaning the local school district spends, three times what they actually get from the state to fund these kinds of measures, including teaching English as a second language to kids that don't speak English. So I think starting in kindergarten, starting before kindergarten and preschool era, promoting things that will increase the level of preparedness for school when kids enter at kindergarten, I think is really important. And those first couple of years are really critical. Kids are incredible learners when they're young, but as they get older, they can't learn quite as well. Whether it's a foreign language, whether it's a new language, whether it's math or science or whatever it is, they have a hard time learning if they don't have that good foundation at the beginning. So I think I'd focus on making sure that early childhood education gets adequately funded and that we also have adequate funding for at-risk kids.
I have a brief follow-up for Mr. Redd. Mr. Thompson indicated how he might try to find additional funding for education. What would you do?
Well, like you mentioned, back in the 1990s, some of the funding for public education, for particularly K through 12, was opened up to higher education. Before that time, all of your income tax, when you guys pay income tax, all that was dedicated to the public education system. But back in the 1990s, I believe, I'm not sure what year it was, higher education was able to get a piece of that pie. And that's a big deal for you guys because you're in the higher education field, and so you want a piece of that pie too, and so do other people. But I think funding for that, comes from income tax right now. Other sources of funding could be the school trust land funds. We can talk about this later if you want, but there's a proposition to have the federal government give back to the state or return to the state control of federal lands. That's pretty controversial, but it actually could provide some good funding for some of these things that we lack funding for right now in the state of Utah.
Well, you've raised the question of public lands, and it's one that occurred to us also.
Yeah.
Let me ask both of you, starting with Mr. Redd, what do you think of the attempt to get the national government to transfer control of a considerable quantity of what is now federal land back to the state of Utah? Do you think that the claims being made by the advocates of this plan have legal validity, or do you think they're a good idea?
Well, first off, I think there's legal history back, basically back in the 1800s. The same thing happened in the Midwestern states, and has been and has happened and been challenged in the past. The Sagebrush Rebellion happened, back when Scott Matheson was governor of Utah, and he was trying to accomplish something similar to what's going on right now. I think that right now you have a federal government that's far away from the lands that they control, and in my experience working with federal government is that they want to do what's right, but they really are not very capable of managing things because they can't see what's on the front lines, what's in the trenches. They can't see what's really going on down on the front lines. On the other side of the equation, you have the state. If the state takes over control of these lands, or the federal government turns control over the states, and the state has to come up with the funding and the infrastructure to deal with managing the lands as well. But I do believe that as a state, if we make some plans in a sustainable fashion, that we can better manage the lands than maybe what the federal government can. Although I still think there's a lot of study that needs to be done to figure out how much that's going to cost and what the financial implications of that would be for the state.
Mr. Thompson.
Well, I think it's an unfortunate and costly joke that they're putting on us. I think that there's no way that the federal government's going to go along with this. You have at least as many attorneys and people in the law field who think this is a total waste of time, and that it'll be a waste of money from the state of Utah's point. Now, if we could get some of that land, I think it could be beneficial to us. But as far as management is concerned, I would simply ask you to compare how the national parks are managed versus how our state parks are managed. And I think if you feel good about that comparison, then I think we ought to go along with it. But my experience is that the national parks are handled very, very well, and the state parks often don't have toilet paper in the restrooms. And so I think that we really have to be careful if we're going to bite off more than we can chew. And not only are we going to bite off more than we can chew, we're going to be spending a whole lot of money doing it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thompson. Let's move to the issue of taxation. As both of you are aware, Utah has been phasing out the sales tax on food. It is somewhat unusual to levy a sales tax on food. What's your position on taxing food? Would you remove the tax entirely? And if so, how might you find a substitute source of revenue? Mr. Thompson, you're first.
Well, I agree that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to tax food. It becomes a very regressive tax because the less fortunate people are spending a greater portion of their income on food than the richer folks, and so you're taxing them at a greater percentage than you would at the for the richer folks. So I don't think that it makes great sense. I think that the balance they've got right now is fairly good. You're never going to get a full without going one way or the other 100%. You're never going to have everyone totally satisfied. But as far as how do we make up the difference in revenue? Well, one of the things that we look at, and it affects education as well, is that we have allowed so many tax exemptions for businesses, for the wealthy, and if we could cut back on those tax exemptions and return some of that money to the general fund and to education, I think that could be a way to recoup what we're losing in the sales tax.
Thank you, Mr. Redd.
I agree. I don't think taxing food is really necessarily a great idea, especially food that's purchased at the grocery store. I'm not sure I feel the same way about restaurant food. I think that's kind of a luxury for a lot of people to go to a restaurant, and I think that basic staples I don't think should be taxed. I think that as far as making up for that, you're either going to have to cut what you spend money on or raise taxes somewhere else or raise revenue somehow. And again, I'm not sure I have all the answers on how to raise revenue or how to make that happen. My thoughts are income taxes are already, at least for a lot of people, are significant. And property tax is already pretty significant for a lot of people. And so if you're going to raise taxes, you're going to have to get buy-in from the public to do that. You just can't just go do it because you want to do it. And so I think that's what the legislature is faced with all the time, is trying to balance, the taxing issues versus the revenue issues. So, and I think it's a problem.
Thank you. You've both been running for some time, talking to a lot of people all over the county. What is on people's minds? What do you hear when people talk to you? What are their concerns? What kind of a mandate do you think you'll have if elected to represent the 4th District?
You want me to start?
You're next,
so,
yes.
I started this campaign back in April, and I spent a good portion of 2.5 months going door to door before the primary election talking to people, and I was really amazed at how many great ideas and insights they had that I hadn't thought of myself. And I'm not sure there's a single issue out there that people are concerned about. A lot of people that I talk to are concerned about excessive government invasion in their lives and privacy and things like that. They're concerned about taxation. They're concerned about school and education. They had lots of different ideas about how to fix the education problem. And I was just really amazed. I was humbled and amazed by what I found by doing that exercise. And you all of a sudden realize that you're not nearly as smart as you thought you were.
Okay. I'd like to follow up on that if I could. We all learn that with age, I think. What was one example of a really good idea that you thought a citizen had?
One person I talked with for about an hour talked about the concept of third-party buying, and the government is a third-party purchaser of goods, who really didn't have skin in the game, and that that the government could never really compete, or could never perform the same functions as private enterprise, the private sector, because they didn't have the same motivation or the same incentives to accomplish what they needed to accomplish. They don't have the same types of incentives, and sometimes that's good. Because sometimes you don't want to be incentivized to do certain things. You want to do the right thing for the right reason. And sometimes financial incentives are not the right reason to do things. And so sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. But I was just amazed at that concept that, that third-party buying is kind of using somebody else's money buying something for somebody else that you're not really involved with, that you don't really care too much about. So you're not as careful with that resource as you might be if you were running your own business, for example, or trying to run a household or make your budget balance.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson.
What's the question?
Again, the question was, you've spent some time here running for this office. You've talked to a lot of people in a lot of different forums. What is on people's minds? Okay. What do you hear from the people? What would you consider your mandate to be from the public elected?
I think without question, the number one issue as I talk with people is education. And they're really concerned about the quality of education our kids are getting. Whether it's a businessman worried about what kind of people he's going to be able to get to work for him, or it's a family who's saying, we'd like to send our kids to better schools, but look what kind of training they're getting, and they need to increase that. So that's probably number one. And the other thing that people keep bringing up is something I just don't know how we're going to deal with, and that's traffic. People always hate traffic. It was when I ran for mayor back in 1997, that was the number one issue then, and it still is, and it's mainly on Main Street. They say, what are we going to do about traffic on Main Street? The other thing, which almost correlates with traffic, is air pollution. People are really becoming worried about that. Quite frankly, I have asthma, and this smell of Idaho forest we've been receiving is exacerbating my breathing problems. And I think that the same thing happens with our own private PM2.5 we get in the winter. We need to start taking care of that. A study from BYU said that on the bad red air days, there is measurable damage done to the heart in one exposure. So we need to do something about that.
Quick follow-up for you, Mr. Thompson. On education, and when you hear from people and they say, we've got to do something to improve public education, can you give me a sense of what kinds of improvements they seek or what plan they might have? Obviously, we'd like to see education improve, but improvements that don't have the support of a significant number of people aren't going to go very far. So what do the people see as the deficiencies and the solutions?
Well, the biggest thing they're worried about is class size. Almost 100% of the people I talked to felt good about the teachers, most of the teachers they had, their kids had. But they felt like when you've got 30, 35, 40 kids in a first or second grade class, it's just ridiculous. Trying to give those kids the kind of attention that they need to have at that age. And so class size seems to be one of the biggest things, but also making sure we recruit and keep good teachers. That was another thing that's on the top of their mind.
Okay. Let's stay with education. There have been numerous proposals over the years, and at one point there was a state referendum on establishing a voucher system in the state of Utah for education K through 12. Mr. Thompson, you're first here, and then Mr. Redd. What's your position on voucher systems in public education?
First of all, I think we need to make sure you are aware of this. Ed and I are good friends. And this, you know, it's going to be hard to find major differences other than nuance in most of our positions. And I think that I really, really respect Ed. I think he'd be a great legislator. But I think I'd be a good one, too. Now, what was the question again?
Whether you support or oppose
vouchers.
Education vouchers in public education. In
I absolutely 100% am opposed to them. And succinctly, I will say this. It makes as much sense for us to have vouchers for private school in public education as it would for our tax money to be going to Westminster College and BYU. Period.
Mr. Rat.
You know, Doug and I agree on this one. I really feel like vouchers basically take taxpayer monies and give it to entities where the taxpayer has no control over how the money's spent, and it's just not a good policy. It's just I don't agree with it.
Quick follow-up for both of you on this. What about the charter school system we have here in the state of Utah, alternative public schools that have license to pursue different educational pathways? I don't know how many we have in the Cache Valley, but at least three or four. Do you think that the charter schools have worked out well for the state? First, Mr. Redd.
I think the charter schools are a good thing on a number of levels. First off, it gives parents a public education choice and allows them to take their kids out of the traditional public setting if they don't feel their kids are doing well there and put them in a different setting where they might have different strategies or different emphasis that might be good for that child. So I think it gives the parent some possibilities to help their child get the best education possible using public funds. So I support the concept of charter schools.
Mr. Thompson.
I agree. We've got a neighbor friend who, bright young lady, really bright, but she was having a very hard time not flunking at Logan High School. And her mother started talking about what she really would like to do, found out she'd really like to get into broadcasting. And so she got down to fast forward and is excelling, doing very well. I think I feel very good about charter schools, just like Ed said. It gives it greater choice. The one problem I've got is that they need to be financed the same way that other public schools, education schools are. The way that they establish their money based on weight of pupil unit, that's really not a nasty word, but I made it sound like that. But what happens is that they are given an amount of money based on how many pupils they have I can't remember exactly how long it is, but it's about a month after the beginning of school. And they get that same amount of money per student for the rest of the year, no matter how many drop out. Whereas the public schools get the money based on weighted pupil unit on a monthly basis. And so if they have kids dropping out of school, they have less money. I think they need to have the same level playing field when they're getting public funds.
Okay. We will take a short break after the next question, just for 1 minute to catch our breath. And so let's throw a tough one out there. And I believe Mr. Red is first on this one. Well, no, I altered. We'll go back to Mr. Thompson on this first. Under Utah law, as I understand it, a concealed weapon permit holder can carry a concealed weapon into a church service. Such a permit holder could also carry a weapon to a public meeting of a city council or some other political body. Are you comfortable with those provisions in current Utah law, or would you like to see them changed? Mr. Thompson first.
I think that pendulums swing with government and with legislation. And I think that the pendulum has swung as far as it can for the right to bear arms. I feel very uncomfortable knowing that somebody might be sitting next to me in church with a gun. It just seems incongruous. Going to a place to worship and talk about peace and love and having a weapon there. Another thing is, I think a business should have the power to say that they don't want to have guns on the premises. And I think that's a right, a property right, that business owner should have. So I think that we don't need to make bearing arms an absolute right. I mean, there's a guy who walking down University Mall with a shotgun, you know, carrying it on his shoulder. And kids were running away from him screaming. I don't think that's right. I don't think it should be done. I think we need to kind of pull back. We need to make sure that people have the right to keep arms and have those arms handy in their homes without question. That should be sacrosanct. But I think we need to be careful about where they're being allowed right now.
Mr. Red.
I probably disagree a little bit with Mr. Thompson on this one. I work at Cache County Jail, and I've had more than one inmate tell me that he was going to kill me after he got out of jail. And they're both in jail still. So I didn't give them the drugs they wanted. I said no. And it was a real scene. And I hate to talk about those kinds of things here in this kind of meeting. But I think there are people in this community who really do have a reason to bear arms in a concealed way. At the end of the day, people need to be able to protect themselves if they feel like they're going to be attacked. If they feel they have reason to believe that they might be attacked, they ought to be able to protect themselves. Whether or not they carry it to church or not is another story. I think churches or private institutions, they can ban weapons from their premises if they want. I agree with Doug on the business things. If businesses don't want people to carry concealed weapons, they can put a sign on the door saying, "No concealed weapons." That's okay as me. But I think the right to bear arms, I think, and to protect yourself in situations where you feel like your life might be threatened is pretty important.
But in the context of a church, you are in agreement with Mr. Thompson that firearms have no place.
No, I'm not necessarily in agreement with that. I say the churches should take a stand on it, and they should basically say, okay, we don't want firearms in our church, and if that's the case, then people who have concealed weapons permits should leave them home. Okay. That's what I think. I think the churches should take a stand on that. I don't think the government needs to make a law about whether people carry firearms into churches or not. I think the church should take care of that.
Just to follow up, okay. Some people perceive that the state legislature made a law entitling people to carry weapons to church when not all the churches supported that law.
I'm not specifically familiar with that law, so you got one up on me there. But if that's the case, I guess I wouldn't support that. I would give the churches the option to say no, and I would give businesses the option to say no too. I mean, if people don't want you carrying concealed weapons on their property, I think. You know, the right to people to control their private property, I think, you know, supersedes the right to carry a concealed weapon.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Just one exception. I think it's okay for the Secret Service to have guns when Mitt Romney's going to sacrament meeting.
We will take a one-minute break and return with more questions. Thank you.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio's coverage of the Vote Utah 2012 debate between Utah House District 4 candidates Ed Redd, a Republican, and Doug Thompson of the Democratic Party. Support this evening comes from the University Inn and Conference Center at Utah State University, open to the public, providing meeting and hotel services to professionals and organizations on and off campus, online at conference.usu.edu. Special thanks to the Utah State University Campus Democrats. You can listen to a repeat of this debate Monday morning at 9 o'clock during Access Utah. We return now to the Ellen Eccles Conference Center on the campus of Utah State University for our live coverage of this debate. Here's your moderator, Utah State University Political.
Let's shift the focus to economic policy now, and specifically the issue of economic development in the state of Utah. What role do you think government should play, if any, in trying to stimulate the free market, create jobs, and develop the state economically? And we go first with Mr. Thompson, I believe, on this one.
I've been involved in economic development for nearly 20 years in one position or another. I've even been on the executive committee for the Utah Economic Development Corporation, and very involved with our city. And I see a real benefit for it. Now, can you say every dollar spent on economic development is going to be giving you a bang for the buck? It's hard to do that. It's like a retailer says that only 50% of my advertising dollars are fruitful, but I don't know which 50%. And so they're spending, still keeping their budget the same. And I think the same has to be with economic development. I think the most important things are to have proper incentives. If we start talking about buying businesses, that just puts us in a dangerous spiral with other states and other institutions. Even in Utah, there's competition between cities and counties. But one example, R.R. Donnelly, when I was finishing up with the Chamber of Commerce and then moving on as mayor, the people at that time who were head of the who were at headquarters wanted to shut this plant down. They had no qualms about it. But we were able to put together a team with the local R.R. Donnelly, well, it was actually Bourne's back at that time. No, not Bourne's. But anyway, it was different iteration. And the state and the local government, and we were able to put together packages that was able to keep them here, and now they hire between 800 and 1,000 jobs, which are saved, which would have gone away without that work.
Mr. Redd, your view on economic development and the role of government.
Yeah, I think government needs to basically incentivize, you know, companies to grow and kind of, you know, cut the regulations as much as they can within reason. I mean, regulations serve some purpose, but sometimes people get overregulated and they can't grow and develop. So getting out, you know, trying to reduce government intervention in business is a good idea. Generally speaking, sometimes using tax incentives to attract certain businesses into an area is a good idea, but you have to be very careful with that one too, because you might be giving unfair competition to one company you're bringing in that might put another company that's already in the valley out of business. And that's something I think you have to be really careful of. If you're going to use tax incentives or you know, give people property tax cuts for a number of years to get them to come here, then you better be careful that you're not stepping on some other people's feet, because there's a lot of small business operators here in Cache Valley that might be injured by having a big brother kind of a person come in and beat them up.
Thank you, Mr. Redd. Mr. Redd, you're next, and the next question deals with the issue of health care, an area where you have some personal familiarity. Let's assume, for the sake of simplicity, that the Democratic health care plan is implemented as we move down the road. What do you think Utah can do on its own to make the quality of health care as high as possible in the state of Utah and reduce costs as much as possible in the state of Utah?
I think there's a lot of things. In private practice and in the jail setting, I found out that people do what's in their own best interest, what they perceive in their best interest when it comes to health care. And so I think you need to give some personal responsibility to everybody in the game, including the patient and the providers, meaning that everybody needs to have a financial stake in what they get. Some diseases and chronic illnesses need to be prevented and managed, like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, mental illness. Those sort of things need to be managed because they cost a lot more not to manage than they cost the general public, whoever's paying the health care bill, a lot more money if you don't manage them. So I think managing chronic illnesses and getting a good system set up to manage those things and take care of them, prevent disease, is a lot cheaper than trying to treat the complications of ignoring the disease and not getting the health care. So I think management of chronic illness is really important, and then giving everybody a financial stake in the game is pretty important too.
Okay. Mr. Thompson, again, just to restate the question briefly.
Thank you.
It had to do with what can we do to improve the quality of health care and as much as possible minimize the cost of health care in Utah, assuming that the Democratic health care plan is implemented as we move down the road?
Well, it doesn't really matter how much more of the Democratic plan, Obamacare, whatever, Affordable Care Act, gets instituted, because we've already got some of the most critical ones in place or are getting close to being in place. Utah has really one of the most clever and well-designed health care exchanges in the United States. It was the counterbalance to the Massachusetts plan, which was totally mandated. Utah's was going to be market-driven. Well, it's been an abysmal failure. And the reason why it has been is because something's called adverse selection. The sick folks who can't get insurance elsewhere are the ones who are signing up for the health care exchange. And so the cost for the health care carriers, the insurance companies, has been so high that they're dropping out. And you're just not getting that many people signing up for it. If you have the mandate, which will come into place, thanks to Justice Roberts, the health care exchange in Utah is going to work. Another thing that can happen is something called an accountable care organization, where the patient, the doctor, hospital, and Medicare are all partners, and the accountable care organization says, we'll take care of this person for X amount of dollars, and Medicare says, we'll pay you for that. And if the hospital is able to do it for less money, they split the surplus. If they don't cover it for that cost, then they eat it. It's a great plan.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson, previously you mentioned that you are distressed by the quality of our air here in Cache Valley at times. And I'm wondering what your position is on the imposition of emissions testing for vehicles here in Cache County, which appears to be a good possibility in the near future.
Yeah, I think whether we do it ourselves or wait for the government, to federal or state government, to lower the hammer, I think it's eventual. But unfortunately, is not that effective. It has some impact, and it will improve the air quality in a measurable way. I'd like to suggest another thing that might be more helpful, and that's that we increase the contribution to the Cache Valley Transit. And they, with another 0.25% sales tax, they could add enough more buses that they feel like they could probably reduce the number of vehicle miles traveled by another million in a few years after that. And I think that would have probably very close or greater impact than would the emission testing. And people then have a greater transportation. The closer you get the bus routes to people's homes, the more they're going to use it. The more convenient it is downtown and for destinations, the more they'll use it. So I think that is something that really needs to be done. I think ultimately, though, it comes down to each of us buying cars that don't pollute, driving less, combining trips, and just being aware of what we can do individually. I'd also like to do something about the diesel and pickup trucks, which are now not under any law for emission control. And I think that they need to have something done to help, to get them to quit putting the black smoke out of those diesels. I mean, they in order to get that black smoke, you have to disable your pollution control equipment on your diesel truck, on the new diesels. So I think that buses, some greater controls.
Mr. Red, just to summarize the question briefly, it has to do with the quality of air in Cache County and whether vehicle emissions testing is an appropriate way to handle the problem.
Well, vehicle emissions testing takes an inherently dirty car and makes it a little bit less dirty than it was already. And it's not nearly, even after it's been inspected and repaired, it's not nearly as clean as cars built after 2007, for example, and newer diesel vehicles that have incredible emission control devices on them, including semi-trucks. So I think, the improvement we're going to get from emissions inspections in Cache Valley is estimated, to be somewhere in the range of 3% or 4% reduction in PM2.5, that's a generous estimate. And so on a badder day when the PM2.5 level's 30, you're going to see it be 29 or 28. And so that's not a huge improvement, but the overall improvement over a period of time by maintaining vehicles and keeping them running as clean as they can and then replacing the old vehicles with brand-new vehicles really does make a huge difference compared to the effective emissions inspection testing. So I think educating people that they lose money when their check engine light comes on, they're throwing gasoline out the rear end of their car, and it costs $4 a gallon almost now. That I'd educate them and say, hey, it's going to save you money to get your car fixed. That's what I try and do. And then I would encourage people, like Doug said, to reduce miles traveled and improve, mass transit if we can. I think that's a good idea. If people use it, it's a good idea.
Quick follow-up for both of you. Would you think that it might make sense in Cache County or Utah to institute some kind of a small-scale Cash for Clunkers program to get some of these cars off the road?
It might actually, in Cache County, be more effective and for the same money as an emission control testing.
I think, do you want to say something else, Doug?
It was my turn. I probably jumped in.
No, there was no turns on that one. I just threw it out there.
I think Cash for Clunkers on the surface seems like a great idea, but I know people that are pretty smart and they'd figure out how to buy old junkers from Box Elder County and bring them over here and sell them to the county for more than what they paid for over in Box Elder County. So I don't think that's necessarily a great way to spend money, but I'm not sure that spending $1.5 million a year on emissions inspections is going to clean up our air that much, and we might be better off spending on buses or something else.
Okay. We've got about 8 minutes to go here. Let me explain what my intention is. I've got one more tough public policy question. I want to go back to education again, since that's on everybody's mind. And then after we've done that question, I've got a couple more personal questions I'd like to ask of each of you. And then each of you will have 90 seconds for a summary statement. And that should take us right about to 7:50, which is when we intended to end the debate. So my public policy question, education policy, is for Mr. Red first. And that is, there are critics who believe that tenure for faculty in public universities has become unnecessary, that it's obsolete. And this is going on in several states, not just in Utah. What is your view on this issue? Do you think tenure in universities is obsolete, or do you think it's necessary?
Well, I think tenure helps keep good professors in the university. And I think finding a good professor and having that person develop his or her skills as a professor takes time. And I think if you don't give them some sort of incentive to stick with the program, I mean, it takes a while to get tenure. If they go to another university, they're going to have to get tenure there too. It gives them some protection. They can put in a lot of effort, which they do during their whole career, in my experience, whether it's doing research or teaching or whatever it is. A truly devoted teacher a professor will get tenure. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think they need to have some protection and some reason to stay in the university, I think. Otherwise, they need to move on. And I don't think that's a good thing for this university or any university, for professors just to go from one place to the next place to the next place. I don't think that's really a good thing.
Mr. Toms.
I agree with that. I just think that one of the biggest problems we've got in Utah is that the people who seem to be calling for tenure to be done away with is the legislature. And what happens is someone from a university pokes them with some information saying that they're not doing things right or they're doing things way wrong, and they get mad and want to get rid of that professor. And I think that we need to have that kind of protection for our good professors. Now, I think we need to ask that same question about public schools. As I talk with administrators, one of the biggest problems they've got is how do you get rid of the really bad teachers? You go to any school, and every teacher, every good teacher, every administrator knows which teachers are the weak ones. And there needs to be something done to make it, you know, fair. It's got to be fair, and it's got to be legal, but it needs to be a little bit more realistic. Right now, the bad teachers get sent from school to school, rather than being sent out. In New York City public schools, they've got the place they call the rubber room, where they send the bad teachers, and they sit there all day playing video games or reading or whatever they want to, and they're paid to do that to keep them out of the system. That's ridiculous. We need to have some kind of accountability.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thompson. Now, on a slightly more personal level, hey, Mr. Thompson, you're first here. What do you enjoy most about living in Cache Valley, and what might be your biggest annoyance in terms of the lifestyle here?
Well, I love living here. We came here by choice. We made a conscious decision of about 28, 30 years ago that we didn't like where we were living in Salt Lake. And so we started looking at what place in the world fit all of our criteria. Logan was the one. And what we really like about it now is it's the great education. You know, USU, good schools for the money we're paying, good neighbors, a safe community. Heaven's sakes, it's the safest community in America. And you can have year-round recreation. This Friday, you've got the choice of a fabulous classical concert up here at USU and the Manhattan Transfer downtown. That's in Logan. Holy moly. And then I'm a road biker, and I just love all the flat roads we have here to ride. I don't like to go up hills, and so that's work. I like to go down hills, but you have to go up a hill to go down. But this is so much to do. And no, I'm not sure that the Wellsvillers are as beautiful as the Tetons, but they are beautiful. But the Tetons don't have a university. They don't have all the infrastructure we have here. And so I just love it here, if you can tell that. I was also head of the Chamber of Commerce for 9 years. That was my job.
So absolutely no annoyances at all.
Oh, air pollution. Honest okay. to goodness, that is for real.
Would have guessed that was coming, yes. Mr. Redd.
Sure. I think the thing that I really enjoy about living here in Cache Valley is the sense of community. When you go places, whether you go to the theater, whether you go to a movie theater, whether you go to the store, whether you're riding your bike down the street or whatever you're doing, people wave to you. They're not just...
And with
all their fingers. good point. and they talk to you, and it's like it's a small enough community that you can actually get to know a significant number of people, and have a lot of people in different areas that you're friends with. I just love it. I think the sense of community here is incredibly strong, and I hope to. You know, if I get elected, or if Doug gets elected, I'm sure he'll try to do the same thing, try to maintain that sense of community, because that is what makes this a really nice place, besides the great views and the fact that the mountains are, you know, 15 minutes away and that kind of stuff. It's really a great place to live.
Any annoyances?
I don't, you know, the air pollution bugs me too, but I try to ignore it as much as I can. I still ride my bike. Right, Charles?
I've got a question for you that... In a Republican presidential debate a few months ago, Mitt Romney just refused to answer. And you'll be first, Mr. Redd. Can you capture who you are and why voters should support you in one word, and one word only?
Dedication. Dedicated.
Dedicated. Very good. Mr. Thompson.
In order to do that, I'd like to have a chair brought up here that I could speak to. The thing that I think I have that may be an advantage is experience.
Experience. Okay. Well, it's time for closing statements. Mr. Thompson, you go first, I believe.
Well, first of all, thanks to the College Democrats for putting this together, and for you for being here and taking all of Ed's abuse. No, you got to understand, we do get along quite well, but I do appreciate what you're doing, and for UPR to broadcast, that's tremendous. I would really like to do this. The more I've thought about it, the more I've put together my campaign, I would really, really enjoy being a state legislator. I am retired, so I can do it, you know, virtually full time. Well, not really, but I would do it a lot. I think that my experience going from energy to economic development to taxation and city situations, solid waste management, figurative and literally, I just have had a lot of experience, and I think that I could really help the state legislature to do the right things. And one thing I think the community needs to know, I am a pretty moderate Democrat. In fact, I call myself a compassionate conservative. I'm really a strong fiscal conservative, but I like to treat people well. And I really believe that Republicans would not be embarrassed by what I do down at the legislature. So I just would ask for the people to consider me and vote for me.
Thank you. Mr. Rad.
Yeah, I just like to tell you this has just been an amazing experience being a candidate. It's been a very humbling experience. Like I said at the beginning, I learned a lot about things I didn't know about, and I'm sure I've got a lot more to learn. I think your elected officials, what I've learned so far, they really do give a lot of themselves to the process, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. They really are in it. And if you go down to the legislature and hang out for a few minutes and watch what goes on down there, these people devote a lot of their time, a lot of their emotional energy, a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of harassment, other things, to try and represent you in this form of government we have. And so I hope you appreciate them. Whether or not you agree with them, I hope you appreciate what they're trying to do. And if I do get elected, I think my strong points are basically my experience and background in healthcare and law enforcement. Working at the jails taught me a lot of things I didn't know about 7 years ago. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Redd. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thank you to our audience. That concludes our debate. Good evening to everyone.
On behalf of the USU College Democrats, we would like to thank our audience members for being here. We've had a wonderful debate and had a chance to get to know these wonderful men that are running for state legislature. We would like to thank Ed Redd and Doug Thompson for consenting to join us tonight. We've appreciated Dr. Lyons' moderation of the debate. We invite you all, on behalf of the USU College Democrats, to come to a town hall meeting with U.S. Senate candidate Scott Howell, which will be held tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock in the TSC Auditorium. Once again, Senate candidate Scott Howell will be in the TSC Auditorium on the USU campus at 1 o'clock tomorrow. That concludes our debate this evening. We invite you to join us for refreshments and a chance to meet with the candidates out in the hall. Thank you.